And I did. I led groups with a focus on the course for a few years in that same decade. And it was great because people were invited to talk about their experience of the course, not about the concepts in it. And the course says, you know, a universal theology is impossible, but a universal experience is necessary, and love is a universal experience. And I like to say that in all the opportunities I had to teach in different places around the world, thanks to Stan Grof and his organizing of the International Transpersonal Association, that I don't think I've ever met anyone anywhere that didn't want to be able to give and receive love. They may feel the lack of it. They may long for it. They may have closed down and not be open to it. But at some level, if you really speak to the soul rather than to the ego, I think everyone has a longing for love. No, that's why Rumi is such a popular poet. If we go deep enough, we all have similar longings, similar hopes and fears, similar hungers, aspirations, and similar desires to be helpful. Compassion is a natural expression of who and what we really are. It's a natural expression of our Buddha nature, or however you name it. There are just so many ways of opening the door to that loving kindness that wants to be expressed. You know, everyone has that capacity, but we're so defended against it so much of the time. So that's like, how do we help each other along? You know, there's a Sufi saying that the task of being human is to transform suffering into joy. So that's a tall order, but it is something that I think, in a sense, we're all called to do. In whatever way, whatever doorway opens up, that we are called to keep focusing on transforming suffering into joy. One of the questions I wanted to give you to reflect on is, when did you first feel a sense of calling in your life? A sense of calling. A vocation. Some people would say a vocation is what do you feel, is what is your calling. Inner calling, outer calling. Just take a moment to close your eyes and think about a time in your life when you really felt a sense of calling. Did you follow it? Did you resist it? Did you push back and forth with it? What called you to be here today?
You.
Well, thank you. I remember that tune, our colleague David Zeller, who used to sing that song, Listen, Listen, Listen to My Heart Song. He used to sing it all at many of our transpersonal psychology gatherings in that decade. That's something that, how do we learn to listen to the voice of the soul instead of the voice of the ego? Because the voice, unfortunately, sooner or later we learn that the fulfillment of ego desires is never fully satisfying. You know? You might get what you want in terms of material possessions or whatever, but then it fades, the satisfaction fades pretty quickly. And they're never fully satisfying. Sometimes the spiritual calling doesn't appear until you have a close brush with death. Many people will suddenly open the door to their spiritual longing and their spiritual growth only when they have either a close encounter with their own death or with the loss of a loved one. Because then we're up against the mystery. But let's take a moment to share something about your calling. Great. Thank you. Yeah. It's true that sometimes it's adversarial circumstances that can precipitate a new opening. And I do want to say something about paradox on the spiritual path, because I think every spiritual path is fraught with paradox. And I like to ask the question of, and just take a moment to reflect on whether you think you've arrived at this moment in your life primarily as a result of your own efforts or primarily as a result of circumstances. Yes, have you arrived at this point in your life primarily as a result of your own efforts or as a result of whatever you want, karma, blessings, circumstances, something outside yourself?
Is there a difference?
Well, sometimes some people think there is and some people think there isn't. So I think that it's like a koan, you know, because one time you may feel one way and another time another way. And that's why I've always been fond of Zen stories, and the one that says, who knows if it's good or bad? You may all know that one about the farmer. And, you know, when the farmer comes to the Zen master and says, my horse is gone, I don't know what I'm going to do. And the Zen master says, who knows if it's good or bad? And so the farmer goes home, and the next day he comes back and says, oh, wonderful news. My horse brought a mare back with him, a wild one, and the Zen master says, who knows if it's good or bad? And then the next day, the farmer comes back and said, oh, terrible news. My son was trying to break in the new mare and broke his leg, and now he can't help me on the farm. The Zen master says, who knows if it's good or bad? And the next day, the army comes and recruits all the young men to go to war, and the son can't go, and so on. You know? So I've often resorted to saying, who knows if it's good or bad? And I still remember at that turning point in my life when I was, clearly wanting to get a job and do something, and I applied to teach at the College of Marin. And I didn't get the job I wanted, and I was so disappointed. I thought that would have been the perfect job for me. But I got a better one. So, you know, you never know. That's been a very helpful phrase along the way, who knows if it's good or bad. And there's another Zen story that I wanted to ask before we get into the next piece of this. I realize we're running out of time, but the student goes to the Zen master and wants to know. He said, can you tell me about death? What do you know about death? And the Zen master said, no, I don't know. And he said, but you're a Zen master. And the Zen master said, yes, but not a dead one. ultimately, I think that we always respond best to each other out of our own experience and not out of necessarily other things, although sometimes it's useful to pass along things that we have heard or that we haven't, you can't experience everything in life. You realize your limitations. And so I want to complete the journey into, as we approach the part of mystery. For me, there were, like, in the first 20 years, I felt that I was taken care of in a way. Then the next 20 years, I had to take care of myself. And then the next 20 years were definitely the inner journey, and the point right after my divorce was when I made that inner commitment to make my spiritual life the center of my life, and it was an important shift. You know, the sort of inner decisions sometimes are really important. And I feel very grateful that my husband persevered in showing up, because it's something that we have been able to share over these years, and that makes that's a great gift. And I one of the lessons in A Course in Miracles says, I do not perceive my own best interests. It took me a long time when I didn't really perceive my own best interest. But another mark of the decade, in 1985, I published my book, The Inward Arc. And that was sort of, came out of my experience teaching transpersonal psychology. I kept on teaching and so forth. And then it was a decade later that I published The Shadows of the Sacred. And that was much more coming out of my deepening spiritual work. And yet there was that sense of wanting to share the things, some of what I had learned along the way and what had been meaningful to me. And so, and after that, I haven't been drawn to writing anymore. And I went through another big transition. Every 10 years, it seems to be inevitable. And in 1995, after I left ITP teaching at Transpersonal, I joined the clinical faculty at the University of California. And then I decided I needed to retire from that. I'd done it long enough. I didn't know what was next, but one thing leads to another, and I had done some consulting for the Fetzer Institute, and it's a philanthropic organization that's based in Michigan, and so I had led a couple of workshops for them, one on esoteric spirituality and one on, I forget what it was called, Wisdom of the Heart or something like that. And then they invited me to join the board, and I was very surprised. But I did join the board in 96. And something really changed for me at that point, because I had up to then been very much doing my own thing, self-employed, having my own practice, running around giving speeches and teaching. And in a sense, seeing my life's work as being about teaching and healing, you know, which essentially is, they're both, in a sense, that's been my calling, my spiritual calling. Oh, I should backtrack for a moment and say that when I was first in graduate school, I went to see a psychic who told me that I had healing gifts, but my healing gifts were in my mind, not in my hands. And it was true. You know, it's like some people really have healing gifts in their hands, but that was not my calling. My calling was to use my mind for healing, and so it's only in retrospect that comes back as, oh, interesting. And so after in 95, now I would say that then came, that started a time of letting go. I decided I'd done enough running around the country giving workshops. I didn't want to travel that much anymore. Traveling gets old after a while. It gets worse and worse as I get older. Anyway, So I stopped doing the workshops, and then I stopped public speaking because that was always a really hard work for me. It wasn't something that I particularly, you know, some people really get off on it. I mean, some people really are nourished by it. So I always felt it was hard work. And so I'm much more comfortable in a smaller group and more in a sort of an exchange situation, whether it's with an individual or other. So joining the Fetzer Institute was a very interesting experience for me because it was beginning to work collaboratively. And so in the last, I've been there now on the board for 17 years, and I have learned to work collaboratively. And it's very different from working all by myself in the world. And I'm very grateful for having had that experience. And that includes learning to work with people that you maybe wouldn't choose to work with, but they show up, and so, you know, you learn from them. At least that's how I try to hold it, is that, you know, I have something to learn here. And it's been a great blessing in my life, and I hope I've made some contribution there, too, in terms of the ideals that they strive for. And they really are committed to connecting the inner life of mind and spirit with the outer life of service in the world. And I can wholeheartedly subscribe to that. And so that's been an education. And now, of course, I complain about, but I also am grateful for, the push to be more more electronically savvy, because, you know, the idea of, it's nice to think of saving paper when we used to get tons of paper, and I've got files full of stuff that I've gotten from Fetzer over the years, but now they send it all on electronically, and I think it's just there's more, because they don't have to print all that stuff out, so they send more stuff. So. And it is an agreement. It's a deep engagement model of leadership. So we are expected to put in 54 days a year, plus and once a week conference call. And so, you know, it's a big time commitment. But I'm grateful for that. And the last piece in terms of this last decade, for the last 10 years, I've had the privilege of working with Frank Ostaseski, who was the founder of the Zen Hospice movement, and he stepped down after 17 years as the director of Zen Hospice and started his own institute called the Metta Institute, and I've been teaching for the program of end-of-life counselor training. So that's been a great privilege and education for me, and I just feel that it's just such a privilege to work with so many people doing such good work in the world, both through Fetzer or through the Metta Institute. It's just inspiring to me because, you know, you don't get that from listening to the news or from worrying too much about the state of the world. Again, you know, it's like we do what we can. And if I come back to, so you do your best and leave the rest, because you can't solve it all. But I just feel so fortunate that with all the, and all the different teachers. Certainly, Buddhism has been a strong influence, but so have many other traditions. I did have the opportunity to travel in India in the 80s when we had a transpersonal conference in Bombay. I spent a month in India and went to Muktananda's ashram, and I had done some intensives here in California with him before that, and I also went to Aurobindo's ashram and also to see Sai Baba and visit the Theosophical Center and do what you do in India. And I went to Mother Teresa's and all of that too. So, and met incredible people. I met the Dalai Lama several times, even before he was famous. You know, he was, I remember his discourse on dream yoga. A very sophisticated discourse through a translator in 1983, and we were in Davos, Switzerland, and he was talking about dream yoga, but I've always remembered it. And when he said, because I've always been interested in dreams and worked a lot with dreams, my own dreams and with other people's dreams, He said, well, we train the monks to be lucid in their dreams. You know, we all have had a taste of lucid dreaming. And then when they've mastered that, then we teach them to be lucid in the waking state as well. And to recognize that this too is a dream. And then when they've mastered that, then they can usually become lucid even in the deep sleep state, so that they can be lucid 24 hours a day. And finally, if they really master that, then they're able to be lucid through the death state. Well, I thought I've got a long way to go. I'm in kindergarten with all these years of dream work. And anyway, it's but it's always a stretch, you know. It's a wonderful opportunity, and I do appreciate the little things that he has said, you know, like something about although it's difficult to think about bringing about world peace through cultivating inner peace one person at a time, but it is the only way. And so in the meantime, we kind of try to treat all beings with friendliness and compassion. And he really does that. He demonstrates, I think, his commitment to those principles of cultivating inner peace. And he always does it with such grace and lightness. There have been many, many people whose paths who have inspired me, I remember Mother Teresa used to say, you and I must go forth and share the joy of loving, but we cannot share what we do not have. That's why we need to pray. And it's something that I feel so grateful for having learned about prayer along the way. I don't think we're aware of the power of prayer in terms of how it affects us rather than whatever we happen to be praying about. And I've liked what Annie Lamott says about there are only two prayers you need, help, help, and thank you, thank you. So I've certainly used help, help a lot, and help shows up. I sometimes say to people, you know, help is there, help is available, but you have to ask for it. You have to ask for it in the outer world, and you have to ask for it in the inner world. And if you truly ask, it will show up. And I think so much, there's so much unnecessary suffering that we impose on ourselves and each other because we haven't learned to ask for help. And that, there is help available, both in the inner world and in the outer world. So it's just useful to know that help is available, but you have to ask for it. Ask and you shall receive, seek and you shall find. All those things, they're actually true. And so, let's see. I did want to share a couple of things here. I'm sure I've shared this before, but while we still have a few minutes left, I'd like to invite any questions you might have for me or anything you feel I've touched on. Yes.
What are your regrets in your life?
Well, I'm feeling pretty clear of regrets at this stage. I think I've certainly had sometimes regrets of perhaps times when I could have been kinder or that I could have been less that would be it, I think. I have regrets about not whatever I did or didn't do with my kids that I might have done better or worse, but I don't know any parent who doesn't feel that. you know. But I'm grateful that we still have a good relationship and have some great grandchildren, and they're good parents. So I guess I didn't do too badly, and so, you know, I'm grateful for that. I'm trying to substitute gratitude for regrets. Yes.
Can you say something about what you've learned from your end of life work?
Can't hear.
I learned about the end of life work. Mm. Well, we all know we're going to die. We don't know when or how, but how important it is to think about it and acknowledge it. I mean, it's part of that existential reality, you know. Once you're born, it's the only way out. And so to be able to speak about it more openly and directly is really, really valuable. And I've also learned that, well, Ram Dass always says, you know, that when you go and sit with someone who's at the end of life, you speak to them soul to soul. You don't try to impose your beliefs or views or whatever, and you just listen. And so it's not different from working with people who are at any other stage of life. But just presence is important. Yeah. Cultivating presence and not worrying about what you're supposed to say, because there's nothing to say. They may want to say something, but they're the ones who are doing the dying. You know, it's not about you if you're coming into to be present with them. So I think that the less preconceived ideas we have about how you're supposed to die, the better, because everybody has to do they're entitled to doing it their way. And a compassionate presence, I think, is probably a great blessing, but not if you're trying to impose telling them how to do it or what they should be thinking about. You know, it's the kind of presence we all would like at any other time, I think. Someone who is willing to be there. A compassionate presence that isn't expecting anything. Does that make sense? Yeah. It makes me want to look up a couple of poems that I brought along, because I think poems sometimes speak to us. I want to share this one too, but I'll try to find the death poem, death ones first. Oh yes, this is one I really wanted to say because it's been... Oh well, I'll be reading poetry for the next 5 minutes. This is from the Analects of Confucius. At 15, I set my heart upon learning. At 30, I had planted my feet firmly upon the way. At 40, I no longer suffered from perplexities. At 50, I knew what were the biddings of heaven. At 60, I heard them with a docile ear. At 70, I could follow the dictates of my own heart, for my desires no longer overstep the boundaries of what is right. And it's a great poem. I've given it to all my friends who turned 70. It's a good 70th birthday poem.
What was it?
Analects of Confucius. But there was... the words of... a couple of things from Tagore. I slept and dreamt that life was joy. I woke and saw that life was service. I acted, and behold, service was joy. That's one of my all-time favorites. I've lived with that one a long time. Let me see. Well, I'll have to tell you by what I remember. But there was something about death is not the extinguishing of the light. It is simply turning off the lamp because the dawn has come. So and we have so many different ways of relating to the end. I mean, when you're having lived kind of recognition of mortality and impermanence, and knowing that everything changes, and that we're not going to be here forever. We only have a limited time left, and so how do we make the best of it? What can we do to help each other along? You know, there's a lot of unnecessary suffering in the world, partly because we don't understand, you know, how the mind has a mind of its own, and that when we begin to recognize the power of intention and the deep internal commitments that we make, how those really do can change in the direction of creating more inner peace, and also to feel at ease with the transitions that come along. I mean, I feel now in retrospect, each transition that has happened for me every 10 years, certainly the last couple of decades have been about letting go. You know, after 60, you know, the children are gone, the professional identity goes. I retired a few years ago, and now I'm no longer carrying that professional, also not carrying that responsibility that I carried for so long. So it's very liberating. Can we turn losses into liberation? You know, at the end of life, the older we get, we do experience a lot of losses. And the older I get, the more of my friends have died along the way. And yet, there's also something that is freeing about embracing change or accepting change, and not feeling that all of a sudden we can stop the clock. Because whether we like it or not, we do age. Sometimes I've said to people, well, you can be in denial about aging through your 60s, but by the time you hit past 70, it kind of catches up with you. You start noticing things. Do you feel that's true? You shared that we're the same age, so. I'll close with this one. It's a Sufi poem. Baba Kui of Shiraz. Only God I saw. In the market, in the cloister, only God I saw. In the valley, and on the mountain, only God I saw. Him I have seen beside me oft in tribulation. In favor and in fortune, only God I saw. In prayer and in fasting, in praise and contemplation. In the region of the prophet, only God I saw. Neither soul nor body, accident nor substance, qualities nor causes, only God I saw. I opened my eyes, and by the light of his face around me, in all the eye discovered, only God I saw. Like a candle I was melting in his fire, amidst the flames out flashing, only God I saw. Myself with mine own eyes I saw most clearly, but when I looked with God's eyes, only God I saw. I passed away into nothingness. I vanished. And lo, I was the all-living, only God I saw. So thank you very much for being here today. It's been a pleasure for me.
Francis, I particularly want to thank you for your trusting of us to share so intimately of your life's journey.
Yes.
And the gift for us is often you hear the term wholeness, we need to grow into wholeness. especially in Jungian work, the accent and wholeness, it becomes a concept until we hear a life story like that.
Mm-hmm.
And we hear all these different facets of the life's journey, and then we actually know what wholeness is.
Mm-hmm.
And especially the way you wove in the opposites of the movement by grace that carries you through and your peace in it, and how that alchemical marriage takes place.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll all carry you and your journey with us.
Well,
thank you.
Thank you. And thank you all for sharing, too, from your heart. Yeah. Thank you, Atum.
Thank you.
I will.
And tell him we're happy he preserved.